But I'd now like to introduce our next speaker, and it's brilliant that we're running ahead of time by 5 minutes. Maurice Frankel is director of the UK Campaign for Freedom of Information. He's been its director since 1987. He's a member of the Lord Chancellor's Advisory Group on Implementation of the Freedom of Information Act, and he's also a trustee of the whistleblower charity Public Concern at Work.
Well, I don't know how I'm going to follow that wonderful presentation. Most of it I didn't understand, but I thought it was still wonderfully educational and informative, absolutely gripping. I'll just start by reminding us how often freedom of information is in the news. These are just some headlines from the last month's stories, with the exception of the first one from The Times. I haven't bothered with The Guardian because that would be too easy. You know, this starts with Clegg having a $1.4 billion fund to stimulate the economy, not one penny of which has yet been paid out, revealed under FOI. This is a Guardian story reported in The Times. That's the number of times that Liam Fox has met with this chap in the MOD. The number of visits has come out within the time scale that the issue is alive. You can see what that is. This is an article by Dominic Lawson in the Sunday Times talking about the number of cases where cases of violence have been dealt with by a caution. And he's saying there's 16,500 in London alone over the last 12 months, and he goes on to discuss the implications of this. This is to do with the civil costs reform, and it's been pointed out that as well as reducing the number of claims that are going to be made as a result of cutting out some of these cases, the NHS is going to lose money because it recovers its costs when somebody wins the case. Well, they're going to stop. They're going to start losing the 200 million if the reforms go through or are successful. You can see, and so you can see what the others are. So freedom of information is hitting the mainstream press, the current news, as it happens. Whether it's getting to the bottom of serious injustices as they happen is a different matter, a more complicated matter, a more difficult to assess, particularly by reading newspaper headlines, which is an easy way of doing of making a point. But still, I put this up as much as anything to reassure myself, because I never believed that this would happen, and each time I see one, I'm still amazed that it's happened, that freedom of information has helped throw light on something significant that is happening now. Now, I'll just go through some of the significant cases where disclosure has taken place on public interest. You know, under the Freedom of Information Act, there's a public interest test, which applies to about two-thirds of the exemptions. And even where the exemption has been made out, even where, in many of these cases, the exemption only applies if there's prejudice to a particular interest, such as international relations or commercial interests or defence, nevertheless, on public interest grounds, you can still get the information unless the authority can show that the balance of public interest favours withholding it. Now, this is, in one sense, a minor case, in another, a significant. Most of this is a Pricewaterhouse report which led to the Bank of England suspending BCCI, and it brought the whole thing to an end. Most of it has been released, but there are still bits of the Pricewaterhouse report that have been redacted and withheld. And there's a request been made for the remaining portions of this, and the Commissioner has found that disclosure would prejudice international relations, and the Tribunal also finds that disclosure would prejudice international relations, but then goes on to set to apply the public interest, and they say the reason that it would prejudice international relations is by exacerbating old wounds with the country concerned, which neither the Commissioner nor the Tribunal names. So for those of you who know the story, it probably won't be difficult to figure out who it is, but even the country is not named in the judgments. And then the Tribunal says considerable public interest in seeing the whole of the report, not strictly speaking for all the information, but to see what role was played by the governments, how the governments and the regulators and the institutions and individuals read this information, what they made of it, and what action they took on the basis of it. And they then go on to say, much of the information has appeared elsewhere, but still, the interest is in seeing what was done, how it was treated, and what was done with it. And those passages, despite the fact that the tribunal has accepted there will be prejudice to international relations, those passages have been ordered to be disclosed on public interest grounds, despite the fact that, and this is an argument to make, so much information has been published about this that why do we need to know? The tribunal says we do need to know. Now, we have a ministerial veto potentially follows the public interest test around. We have a ministerial veto which, in the Act, which luckily has only been used twice in relation to the decision on the publication of the Iraq cabinet minutes and on a decision on a cabinet subcommittee on devolution. Both cases, the first case, the tribunal order disclosure, the second case, the commission order disclosure, governments intervened to use the veto, but that's twice in 6 years. Now, that's another thing which I didn't expect to happen. I thought that veto would come out of the box pretty regularly, and it hasn't. Government has been very restrained, very embarrassed about using it, and has only done it when it thinks it can make a very strong case of principle, as in relation to cabinet. Now, you know, we're still compared by some commentators adversely with the US Freedom of Information Act. The US Freedom of Information Act hasn't got a public interest test in any exemption except the privacy exemption. That's the only exemption that can be overturned in the US, in the federal legislation, on public interest grounds. The idea that of being able to overturn a finding that there'd be harm to defense, harm to international relations, harm to law enforcement, harm to trade secrets, harm to commercial interests, or a disclosure of legally privileged material, or of policy advice on public interest grounds would be unthinkable in the US federal context. And while I'm having a go at the US Act, excuse me, because so many people have a go at the UK Act by comparison, there's a very important NGO in the States that every year publishes a list of the 10 longest delayed freedom of information requests to each government agency. And the longest one last year was 13 years. That is to say, it's still being processed after 13 years. Somebody made a similar request to the FBI for what was the longest time it was taking to process a request, and after 10 months, it still hadn't responded to that request. Okay. So the problems that we've had on delays, and we have had problems on delays in the UK, are still are minor compared to what happens in some of these jurisdictions. This is Nicholas Gilby's case. I'm sorry if I'm stealing his thunder this afternoon, but because it is, again, international relations, and it's a core national interest, and this was a request for information about the arms deal, the Adiyamama arms deal. Tribunal accepted good relations with the Saudis would be prejudiced by disclosure. That was a key national interest, should be protected, and found that the public interest favoured withholding most of that information, except where the information related to British officials' involvement in payment of bribes. Not that they were accepting bribes, they were facilitating the payment of bribes to people who needed the bribes before they would do anything. And here the tribunal said, even though there's harm to a key national interest, it should be disclosed on public interest grounds, and it has been, and the veto has not followed. This is an early case from the tribunal under the exemption relating to the formulation of government policy, and the tribunal said strong public interest in knowing how lobbyists are attempting to influence government, very topical today with what's happening in the MOD, and this chap Warity, whose true role we don't yet know, but may well be falling into this category, so that other counterbalancing views can be put, and that there is not and is not to seem to be an appearance of impropriety. Again, a classic public interest type of principle, classic thing that the newspaper editors would say if they're writing their editorials, and here it is in a judgment from the tribunal, and disclosure follows. This is a commissioner decision that didn't go on, wasn't challenged. Distraction techniques used on young people in insecure training centres, and this is keeping them under control when they're violent or aggressive by the deliberate infliction of pain. And the commissioner found that two exemptions applied, but notwithstanding that, the public interest favoured disclosure because of the dangers of these techniques, which are quite brutal and dangerous techniques, and shocking to read the extracts now that they have been released after a prolonged effort under the Act. Now, I thought I would tantalise you with this one on legal professional privilege. Legal professional privilege is an exemption, which is a qualified exemption under the Act. It is subject to the public interest test, surprisingly. Surprisingly, because government lawyers drafted this. It wasn't something that was snuck through past them. Most of the cases where privilege has been demonstrated to exist, public interest arguments have failed. And the case that goes back to the House of Lords ruling about significant inherent public interest in the protecting the confidentiality of clients' discussions with their legal advisors. Now, here's one which I think is quite significant. This bill passed in 2008 introduced imprisonment for health and safety offences, something which the health and safety lobby have been pushing for taking safety offences more seriously. The Health and Safety Work Act reverses, in any case, the normal burden of proof. So, in other words, it's not for the prosecution to prove that you're guilty. You have to prove that you're innocent. And the requester, who's a lawyer, wanted to see the legal advice on which the DWP satisfied itself, and there was a statement on the front of the bill, that this was compatible with the Human Rights Act. And this is the reversal, this is the extract from the Health and Safety at Work Act, the reversal of the burden of proof. You wouldn't be very happy facing this test if you were the defendant. And you would be particularly unhappy if you were facing the possibility of imprisonment if the case went against you. And so there's quite an interesting point. How is that compatible with Article 6? Well, this has been to the Court of Appeal a number of years ago, before imprisonment was put on the cards. And this is what the court said. In the circumstances, justify necessary and proportionate, not least because there's no possibility of imprisonment. So now that imprisonment has been put into the statute, this chap is saying, I want to see the basis on which you've satisfied yourself that Article 6 is still being complied with. And the tribunal has said, unfortunately, at the time this request was made, the bill was going through Parliament, and therefore the issue was still live. And in the balancing test, the public interest balancing test that's applied here, if the issue is live, that's a very, very strong factor against disclosure. But the tribunal says the chap, since the bill became law, has made another identical or wider request, but including the same information to the DWP. It's unlikely to be live. And the tribunal says, although we're not finding for the appellant in this case, we recommend the DWP reconsider now that the Act is on the statute books. And so I tell you that to tantalise you, because, of course, if you're involved in JR, you will never get the other side's legal advice at a time when it might be of use, practical use to you, because by definition the case will still be live. But in other, in other circumstances, in other situations, that door is just slightly open. And again, it's a mark of the potential power of the legislation. The delays, I mentioned the US delays. We've had our problems with delays, not least in the Commissioner's office, which at one point had managed to gradually run up the length of time it was taking to deal with decisions, so that some of them were taking over 4 years from the making of the complaint to the issue of a decision notice. Well, you can imagine what the effect of a 2, 3, or 4 year delay on the requester is, and on their ability to receive information that's useful to them, and their willingness to engage in the process again after that. happily, the Commissioner's office has now cleaned up its backlog very effectively and now deals, it has a target which it meets of dealing with 90% of its cases within 6 months and all of its cases within 12 months, and it appears to be dealing with that. So now the focus is switched back to public authorities handling this case, because now you can get to the Commissioner in time while you're still alive and hope to get a decision, you know, before you, you know, they're carted off to the crematorium. So what are the problems getting the information from the public authorities? Well, one of the things that has been happening has been authorities adding new exemptions. As the requester manages to defeat the exemption that has been put up to oppose them, lo and behold, a new exemption appears in its place. And sometimes a new exemption is not actually raised until the Information Commissioner has begun his investigation. And sometimes you're not even told that a new exemption is on the table. The first you know about it is when you get the decision notice, when you discover that your arguments demolishing the original exemption have succeeded, but unfortunately a new one has been substituted and you've not been offered the opportunity to comment on the new one. And it appears in the final decision. And if you have any arguments, you've got to make them to the tribunal. The tribunal had believed that it had the discretion to deny authorities the opportunity to bring in a late exemption in this way, that the commissioner had it and that the tribunal had it. The upper tribunal has now said that that's not correct. Public authorities entitled to bring in a new exemption at any time, including, at any time all the way up to the Supreme Court. Which is obviously very frustrating from the requester's point of view. But there's a second decision that's gone with that, and that is about a variant of that, which is not to introduce a new exemption, but to switch from an exemption to a refusal on the grounds that the Act's cost limit would be exceeded. And so if when dealing with central government, the cost of locating the information is more than £600, and that's just the cost of finding, locating, and retrieving the information, the authority can refuse to deal with the request. And what happens, and has been happening, and this is a request from the all-party group on extraterritorial rendition, which was asking for agreements between the British government and the Afghan, Iraq, and US governments on the treatment of renditioned or rendered personnel. And the MOD had been refusing this for 12 months on the grounds that disclosure would harm our relations with those countries. And then suddenly they discover, while carrying out their internal review, that no, the real issue is they would have to search 7 different departments in the MOD, and the cost of those searches has already exceeded £600. And so having kept the requester, the all-party committee, waiting for 12 months, while they dealt with arguments on international relations, they suddenly switched to an argument that the cost limit allows them to refuse straight off. And the tribunal here, first of all, casts doubt on the previous upper tribunal's ruling that there is no discretion to allow late claiming of exemptions. But they say, in any event, that doesn't apply to the late claiming of a cost limit refusal, and part of the argument is that the Act says you can apply for similar information after 60 working days, and your slate is wiped clean. So if you go up to the £600 limit in your first request or group of requests after 60 working days, you can start again with another batch of related information. And what they've said is that by making these people wait a year while they argued about international relations and then pulling the cost limit out of the bag, what they've actually done is denied them the opportunity to make 5 or 6 sequential requests sequential requests at 60-day intervals in which they would have got all the information, most of the information that had been withheld. And they're saying the later the claim, the more the prejudice. And so that late claiming of the Section 12, or the cost limit, has been stamped on by the upper tribunal. Now, that's all in the past. Those are decisions we've had. I'm going to give you one more, even more significant decision. Now, you won't think it's significant when, from reading the title of the slide, but you'll see why it's significant when I come on to the next issue. This was a request from somebody. London Borough of Islington used national car parks to do their traffic warden parking tickets, penalty notices, and the request was discovered that NCP had an Argos points incentive scheme. Traffic wardens who reached their targets or exceeded their targets got points to spend at Argos plus bonus payments. And this chap made exactly the request you would hope that somebody would make. I'd like to see the number of tickets issued per parking attendant. I don't want their names anonymised. I want the number of complaints and the number of cancellations. Did they go up to the threshold to get the points, and did they later have all those tickets cancelled? You know, good freedom of information request, intelligent, thoughtful use of the Act. Council, we don't hold information about the Argos points and who got them. National Car Park, NCP, hold that information. Go to NCP. NCP ask the council for it. We don't deal with freedom of information requests. We're not a public authority. Now, under Section 3.2b of the Freedom of Information Act, information which is held by the authority or held by another person on behalf of the authority is subject to the Act. If it's, someone else holds it on your behalf, you hold it if you're the public authority. Now, this then goes to the Information Commissioner, and this is what he says. We would regard it as held on behalf of the contractor if the contract said you must gather this information or provide it to the council. We've looked at the contract, and there's no evidence of any contractual requirement to hold or provide information about Argos points to the council. We conclude that NCP holds it for its own purposes and not on behalf of the council, therefore this information is not disposable under FOI. Okay? It's tough luck for a guy that wanted to cast light on the Argos points scandal, but it has more important implications, and this is what they are. The NHS reforms that are going through Parliament at the moment involve NHS commissioning bodies, which will be commissioning consortia, commissioning clinical groups, built around GPs with various other people added on, who will commission services either from independent providers or from NHS bodies, and they will be competing with each other to get the business. The new commissioning bodies will be subject to FOI in their own right. They will be public authorities under the FOI Act, and the NHS bodies are, of course, public authorities, but the independent providers, the private hospitals, are not going to be subject to the FOI Act in their own right, but they will be contractually required to cooperate with the commissioning body when the commissioning body gets a request. So you have the NCP parking ticket situation. Somebody makes a FOI request to the commissioning body for what's going on in the independent or the private hospital under the contract to treat NHS patients. They're contractually required to help the commissioning body answer the FOI request. And that answer has helped to diffuse a lot of the criticism in Parliament about the fact that the providers are not subject to FOI in their own right. The NHS already has a standard contract which already has precisely this type of clause in it, and this is the clause it has. The provider agrees to the agreement and any other recorded information held by the provider on the commissioners, that's the commissioning body's behalf, for the purposes of the agreement, are subject to the commissioning body's obligations under FOI. And that's what satisfied everybody that the issue has been taken care of, albeit through a contractual provision. Now, I looked at this and I tried to work out what it meant. And then I read the contract, which was no easy task, particularly for me, because the contract's 88 pages long, and then the schedule is another 88 pages long. So I had to go through 160 indigestible pages worth to try and figure this out. And what I tried to figure out is, what information is held on the commissioning body's behalf? Well, it's a circular argument. If it's held on their behalf, it's subject to the Act in any case. So what does this definition mean? If it's held on the commissioner's body's behalf, the provider agrees. If it's held on their behalf for the purpose of the agreement, the provider agrees it's subject to the FOI Act. So what does that mean? Well, I said, presumably means what the Argos decision said it means. If the contract requires the provider to record that information or to provide it to the commissioning body, then it is held on behalf of the commissioning body for the purposes of the agreement. That was my conclusion. Now, there's a section in the contract. You see how far I had to go through it to dig it up. I promise you I read all the provisions and all the previous and all the subsequent schedules. And here it says, the information gathered for the purpose of reporting, and basically they say that the providers have to meet the same reporting standards to the Department of Health as NHS bodies, and they specify what has to be done. And here's the beginning of quite a long list of what the NHS independent providers have to report on. Some quite good stuff: equality monitoring, complaints monitoring, climate change reports, performance against, you know, against targets and so on. Then we come to this kind of provision. The provider's got to have properly qualified medical and other staff. If requested, they must provide the commissioning body with evidence that they're complying with that requirement. Well, how does that fit into the FOI duty? Well, if the commissioning body asks for it, they've got to provide it. So if you ask the commissioning body for it, it's got to ask the provider for it, and so you will get the information from the commissioning body anyway, because they're entitled to it, must be held on its behalf. But if they don't ask for it, you would have to make them ask for it in order to get it, but that would be covered. But now look at this. The services environment, the hospital, the wards, the mobile cancer screening caravan unit, is clean, safe, suitable, sufficient, adequate, functional, accessible, and effective. That's a requirement of the contract. There is no requirement, as far as I can see, in the contract to report, to record, for the provider to record the results of any inspection or to keep any records about that. There's no duty to report on it. Now, whether you can argue there's an implied contractual obligation to do something is way above my level of understanding, but I wouldn't rely on it in FOI terms, and I spoke to a number of lawyers who say it is not safe to rely on it. If it's not specified in the contract, it's not safe to rely on it. So my reading of it is there's a good chance that if you ask for information about the standards of cleanliness in a private hospital under an NHS contract, you will have no right to the information once these reforms are in place. If there's a scandal about contaminated blood supplies or supplies of any kind of equipment, at the moment you can go to an NHS body and you can say, I want to know how much of this product you've got from this supplier, how much of it have you used, what tests have you done on its quality yourself, how many patients have been treated, how many have come down with anything unpleasant, what action have you considered? Can I see the minutes of any meetings to discuss this? Can I see the policies, the protocols? Can I see what options you consider? Can I see your correspondence with the supplier of this equipment? The whole thing is within the scope of the FOI Act, subject to the exemptions. In my reading, most of it will not be subject to the contract if the contract stays as it is. And this is just, I don't know if you can read this, but you'll get the text afterwards. This is what they call a disclosure log, a typical NHS trust publishing the list of information about what it's disclosed in the last 2 years. And these are all clickable, and a whole menu opens up under each one of these items of information disclosed to requesters. Large parts of these are not going to be covered by the contract, as far as I can see. And so what we are going to find, if we're not careful, is once these reforms go through, our rights to know what happened will be strong where an NHS body is still doing it, and weak when a private provider has it. And the whole momentum of the scheme will be to transfer this work into private providers, and I think our rights to know what's going on are at peril as a result of this change. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was a wonderful and riveting journey round a very complex piece of legislation. We've got 5 minutes left for questions. There is a roving microphone, so Morris is here to answer any questions or comments that you may want to make on his brilliant presentation.
This is what my father predicted would happen to his speech. That's why he said he wasn't going to take questions at the end of his talk. I was foolish enough to allow 5 minutes because I never allow any time. I always run 10 minutes over my allotted slot. I said, I'm not going to do that to the Public Law Project. I'm going to finish a couple of minutes at least early.
Can I make a comment? Because I'm a trustee of a private healthcare provider which does provide services to the NHS under contract. And I would like to think that reputable private providers will be keen to provide this kind of information anyway, simply to demonstrate that they're able to provide services to a comparable standard. And if they have problems, they want people to know what those problems are. So maybe I'm taking an unduly rosy-tinted view of the private sector. But, Morris, do you think that's something that, in terms of the culture, that one would want to encourage?
One would want to encourage it, but I wouldn't want to rely on the culture. No. I'd like to rely on the law.
Yes, exactly. I have a question over here. Full force of the law, of course.
Hello? Is this working? Yes. Do you have any insights into, I think it's the criminal investigation section of the ICO under Section 77, and how that works or doesn't work? Maybe you don't.
In general, or in relation to any particular.
Well, I've been trying to use this via frustration with the council, and I got a little way with the investigations team, I think, but they then said things like, "Well, you know, actually, we've never actually done a prosecution, so we actually have no teeth at all." Yeah. I wondered if you.
The prosecution has got to be brought within 6 months of the offence occurring. Because it's tribal only in the Magistrates' Court, and this is the standard, this is the normal rule under the Magistrates' Court Act. In a number of areas, the government has amended the legislation to extend this period for periods of 2 or 3 years, simply because it's impossible to find the evidence of the offence within 6 months in many cases. So, for example, under the building regulations, very often the new owner of a property finds the building regulations not being complied with. It's more than 6 months. If it's within 3 years, they can still prosecute. We raised this 2 years ago with the government. We got an amendment down, which we, Lord Dubs, moved in the House of Lords. The government refused to extend the six-month period on the grounds there wasn't sufficient evidence that this was a problem. It was obvious that it must be a problem because at that time the commissioner was taking 8 months on average to begin an investigation. So his chances of finding the evidence of the offence within 6 months was pretty minimal. This has been raised in relation to Michael Gove's emails and the use of private email accounts. And the question is, when the Financial Times made a request to the Department for Education for this, and they specifically said, please ask the Secretary of State and his special advisors for any emails on this subject held in their private accounts. If they asked and then were told, we don't have anything, and that was not true, that's potentially an offence under Section 77, which the Commissioner is said to be investigating at the moment. So we may find out more about how that provision works in the near future.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, ladies and gentlemen, shall we now break for coffee and be back sharp at 11:30 for Richard Herman's presentation? Thank you all very much.